From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Split show for you tonight. Next hour, The Binary Star with Walter Cruttenden, followed by The Yugas, Keys to Understanding Our Hidden Past with Joseph Selby. But here's what's happening. Oh, no, here we go. A big sunspot is emerging over the sun's northeastern limb. It has at least four dark cores and is crackling along with some small flares right now. NOAA forecasters estimate that a 60% chance of an M-class solar flare, now that's the second largest you can get, during the next 24 hours because of its location near the sun's limb. Now, so far, it does not pose a threat for Earth because it's not pointed directly at us. But they say it could change in the days ahead as the sunspot turns to face our planet. Stay tuned. We'll follow it. Republican presidential nominee Rick Perry spoke in Iowa and had some pretty nasty words for Ben Bernanke. Unusual words for the head of the Federal Reserve. Perry told supporters at the end of his first full day of campaigning in Iowa that he wasn't a big fan of the head of the Fed and suggested that Texans would probably beat him up if he prints any more money before the next election. Andre Aguilachan, of course, successful entrepreneur and host in his own way, is on with us now. Not very presidential, was it, Andre?
No, it wasn't, George, and thank you for having me. I think that, with Rick Perry saying what he said, he made a mistake. He shouldn't have said it.
Now, I hope nobody takes him seriously and goes and beats up poor Ben.
No, I don't think that... No, they would do another JFK or something like that on old Ben Bernanke down in Texas. You know, I understand what Rick Perry was trying to do. I mean, he accused the Federal Reserve Chairman of playing politics, where in actuality, I think that Governor Perry is the one playing politics. I think that he wants the Tea Party and Republicans to believe that the Federal Reserve is working in cahoots with the White House to pump money into the system for the purpose of Obama creating jobs so that he can get reelected. I think the governor should know, and if he doesn't know, he has no business running for the White House, but he should know that the Federal Reserve is a privately owned central bank, completely, totally independent of the White House. The White House has no jurisdiction over the Federal Reserve whatsoever.
And, of course, he's a head. Rick Perry's ahead in the polls, way ahead of Romney right now, and he just popped in all of a sudden.
Yeah, he did. And making these kinds of gaffes, I think, is going to end up hurting him. I mean, you know, the Fed, if they are playing politics, they're doing a doggone good job of it, George, because in the last, 3 years since the beginning of this recession, 90% of the stimulus has gone to the banks. It hasn't gone to small businesses to create jobs. And the banks aren't going to lend that money to small businesses right now for several reasons. They're making more money gambling with it on Wall Street. Small businesses aren't very creditworthy right now, and the banks need the capital to shore up their reserve ratio requirements. So the money's not going to work its way into the system before the election.
All right, my friend. Thank you, Andre. Andre Aguilachan. Spending your days in front of the television may contribute to a shortened lifespan, according to a new study. Researchers in Australia found that people who averaged 6 hours a day of TV lived on the average of nearly 5 years less than people who did not watch it. They have no idea why. For every hour of television watched after age 25, your lifespan will drop by 22 minutes. Take heed. Listen to this story. The Detroit Police Department says it will not respond to most burglar alarms at homes and businesses unless a company has been verified by an alarm company that there's a crime. The plan was pitched in April to a Detroit City Council committee. At the time, it was described as an effort to free up more officers to respond to other emergencies. Recent violence in Detroit has made that need more urgent. The department says more than 98% of alarms that its officers respond to are false. Under the new policy, an alarm company must verify that the alarm is not false before contacting police. Now, Rick Johnson in St. Louis is an expert on all this stuff. Rick, how does an alarm company know if it's a real burglar?
Well, actually, George, they have no way of knowing that. When the alarm sounds, it notifies the central station, and they in turn dispatch the authorities to the address of the alarm. The only way they would know if it's an actual alarm is in fact when they actually go to the premises where the alarm was sounded at.
And if the police department doesn't go and check it out, then these burglars are going to run rapid through this house, right?
That's exactly correct. And in fact, what I believe is due to some of the cutbacks, they're prioritizing. In other words, if the home alarm goes off versus a business goes off, depending on the municipality and what zip code, if you will, determines that, again, with respect to how they dispatch to that, again, that address.
All right. Thanks, Rick. Now, that's an unbelievable story out of Detroit. If you're a burglar, I guess you know what to do. If you're one of millions of dog owners in the Los Angeles area, be sure to keep an eye on your beloved four-legged friend. Dog thefts are up 32% this year, according to the American Kennel Club. Stolen dogs are almost always resold and are often used in laboratories or dog fights. Pit bulls and other large breeds are stolen the most frequently. Purebreds are also at risk because thieves think they can get a lot of money for them. In the news at coasttocoastam.com, is there a new chupacabra? A mystery animal. People don't know what it is. It's a deer-like creature. They call it Prince Chupa. Go ahead and take a look at it. See what you think. SETI telescopes looking for the extraterrestrial intelligence should reopen within weeks after donors replaced income lost in public funding cuts. The Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Institute had to shut down the $30 million Allen Telescope Array in April. Donors, including actress Jodie Foster, raised more than $200,000. Here's Seth Shostak with us. He works at SETI. Finally, good news here, Seth.
Well, it is, George. It's not only good news, it's also very gratifying that the public is sufficiently interested in what we're doing, even in a time of economic downturn, to put their monies where their mouths are.
Well, now, when are you going to really get things up and running again?
Well, the money that was raised via a crowdsourcing a project called SETI Stars amounted to a little over $200,000, and that was raised in 2 months' time. Now, we have to combine that with other monies, because that money by itself is not completely sufficient to operate the array. It's kind of a down payment on operating the array. We're looking to get monies primarily from the U.S. Air Force. They have been interested in using the array. They have been using the array for their own purposes, for charting satellites and space debris. If they come across in the next month or so, then the array will be up and running, aimed at the sky within a month or two.
That's good news. Thank you, Seth. Listen to this great little story. There's a little pint-sized preacher out there. He's 4 years old. Cannon Tipton. He's a preacher. He's become a YouTube sensation. He brings congregations to their feet. He's appeared on a television special. And you know what? He's just about starting the first grade. He hasn't even started yet. He's 4 years old. Dubbed the world's youngest preacher, the four-year-old from Mississippi has galvanized audiences in person and online. Take a listen to him.
The Lord is here tonight. And his name is Jesus. There's only one God. And then he's going to praise out his tears and just worship God. And then he's going to worship God. But the Lord is going to do it. That means God has to do it.
Little Cannon Tipton, 4 years old. He electrifies the crowd. Britain came up with a bizarre plot to win the Second World War. They wanted to turn Hitler into a woman. I kid you not. The Allies hoped to smuggle female sex hormones into the Führer's food in an attempt to curb his aggression. It was just one of a number of outlandish ideas to break the war stalemate, according to a new book. Others included dropping glue on Nazi troops in an attempt to stick them to the ground and disguising bombs and tins of fruit being imported to Germany. They're revealed for the first time in Secret Weapons Technology, a book by a professor in England. Minnesota Representative Michelle Bachmann and presidential hopeful stepped all over Elvis Presley's blue suede shoes while stumping Tuesday when she mistakenly wished the king a happy birthday. August 16th actually marks the 34th anniversary of Presley's death. Fans from all over the world, including Brazil and Japan, flocked to Graceland in Memphis, Tennessee, to pay tribute to the music legend on the anniversary of his death. Close to 20,000 mourners came to the estate where Presley lived and where he is buried in the Meditation Garden to hold a candlelight vigil for the fallen star. The singer died there in 1977 from a heart attack at the age of 42. Even decades after his death, he remains one of the highest-earning celebrities, according to Forbes. His estate earned $60 million in 2010. In a moment, our Gary Patterson joins us, and Patrick Lacey, author of Elvis Decoded, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Two guests for you this hour. Gary Patterson is a published author with a passion for rock and roll. Gary works and portrays many fascinating events that have helped shape musical history from Robert Johnson through current groups, making a place for themselves among rock and roll standing legends. Here's Gary Patterson. Gary, how are you?
I'm doing great, George. How are you?
Good to have you. And here's Patrick Lacey, spent nearly 10 years researching, writing, and talking to some of the most credible and incredible sources in the strange, claim-filled world surrounding the myths and legend of Elvis Presley, his work Elvis Decoded. Here's Patrick Lacey on Coast to Coast. Patrick, hi.
Hey, George. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. Gary, $60 million he earned last year. The guy's dead. Is that more than when he was alive?
Well, actually, I think Patrick will tell you that at the time of his death, I think he had $10 million, and Patrick will have to confirm that. But, yeah, it's like Jimi Hendrix said, George, once you're dead, it's funny how people love the dead. Once you're dead, you're made for life, or your estate is anyway.
The same as Michael Jackson. They're starting to make a lot of money now.
Well, you know, there's a good link there, you know, the king of rock and the king of pop, and that's basically how you do it. You know, when someone dies and you have Graceland, it becomes a great venture, then why not Neverland, you know, for Michael Jackson? So, you know, it's funny because we love these artists because we grew up listening to them, and, you know, they seem to transcend what humankind would be. So they're almost immortal because the music makes them that way, and there's always going to be an interest.
Patrick, 34 years since Elvis has passed away. His last year, he was spiraling downhill, not making some concerts, passing out in his dressing room. What happened to the guy, Patrick?
Well, over the past few years of his life, I think, you know, I agree with you, he was spiraling, and the trajectory was certainly headed down fast, and it was the drugs. You know, a lot of people want to be apologists for him and say that, you know, he had X number of problems that he was dealing with. And Elvis did have a lot of problems. But it was the drug intake and the fact that he had, you know, doctors who handed him drugs when he wanted them. He had, you know, the people around him who didn't do anything really. And you know, there's arguments and debates there on what they could have done. And those are valid debates to look at. But it was the prescription medication. Probably just he was at a point in his career and in his life where he may have become bored, and the drugs affected him that much worse because he really didn't have anything to look forward to.
What is it about successful people, Patrick? I mean, here was Elvis. I mean, the king of rock and roll. Just, you know, just people just adored him, yet he was paranoid. He was afraid of certain things. He was depressed. Why did he destroy himself?
Well, he could have become that way because of the drugs, and then you might bring a parallel into that and look at, like, Howard Hughes. Certainly Howard Hughes started off his life pretty normally, and then he went downhill too. But Elvis just had a lot of problems, and it was hard to get out of it. And you know, for those last 4 or 5 years of his life, he wasn't challenged. He really didn't have anything to look forward to. He wasn't doing anything particularly, you know, exciting to him. He was on these tours that were never ending. They weren't even the big coliseums and stuff. They were these, you know,
small towns, weren't they?
Yeah, small towns. I mean, ticket prices, Gary and I were talking about this the other night, you know, were $7, $8, $9, $10, you know, so the money wasn't, you know, coming in. He had all these people to support, so it just wasn't a good life for him by that point.
Why wasn't he doing the big Vegas shows toward the end?
Well, he was still in Vegas for those years, and he was still selling them out.
Okay.
But that, even though he was making good money there, it wasn't enough because he had, as we all know, expensive tastes, and he was generous with his money. And And he had a lot of people to take care of, and just the money wasn't there with these tours. And as Gary just mentioned about the money at the end of his life, it's hard to pinpoint how much he had, but certainly looking at his wealth over the years, we would have thought that he had would have had a lot more at the time of his death.
Gary, August 16th, 1977, take us back to that day. What happened?
Well, I tell you, it's one of the days in my life that I'll never forget, because I was in a music store buying an amplifier, because I play guitar, I love rock and roll, and I heard an announcement on television, George, that said, the king is dead. And that's just what they said. And, you know, when it hit me, I thought, surely they're not talking about Elvis Presley. And it turned out they did. Because, I mean, and Patrick can tell you that I think it started maybe 1:30 p.m. in Memphis, maybe 2:30 when the ambulance got there. And, you know, they were just breaking alerts that they'd found him passed out in his bathroom, and they tried to give him CPR in the ambulance on the way to the hospital. And when they finally gave up working on him, then, you know, they had to make an announcement, but they didn't want to make the announcement he had died until they told Vernon, his father. And, you know, there were people wailing, I mean, standing at Graceland at the gates, the family inside, so much confusion. And it captured the attention of the world. I mean, it was in every country. In England, England always worshipped Elvis. I mean, John Lennon said, before Elvis, there was nothing. So it had a huge effect worldwide. And when the music played, you know, it brought you back, and it brought back the sadness of listening to it, because, you know, you saw the promise that he had in 1956 when he was doing those great songs from Lieber and Stoller and, you know, Hound Dog and all that. Then he went in the Army, did the movies, his whole career, and to think that it was over. And there was a definite sadness and a great stillness.
That picture we saw in the National Enquirer of Elvis, purportedly Elvis, in his casket, was that real?
Well, I think one of the cousins took the photograph. You know, it's amazing what you can do for money. I remember they also had a photo in the National Enquirer of John Lennon in the morgue. And, you know, of course, the picture taken from the side, and I think Patrick will know which member of the family did that. But, you know, that sort of gave idea that, oh, well, you know, it doesn't look the same. It might be a wax dummy, and Elvis faked his death. And it goes into the great trauma of what it would be if Elvis had escaped death and Elvis was alive and faked the whole thing. So maybe that picture was one thing. But I do remember seeing it. And, you know, when I saw it, it just made me feel sad, you know. It was just the idea that, you know, he was gone.
Patrick, why the rumors that Elvis faked his death?
Well, I think the easy answer is that people don't want to let him go. And as Gary mentioned, he and I were talking about this the other night, when you have somebody that big in life, it's hard to look at them dying in such a way that is so typical and so normal. And it made people maybe feel like they missed out, or, you know, Elvis was taken way too early, which of course he was. But the secondary answer to that, and one that needs a little bit more examination, which I've done, is that a lot of the Elvis is Alive stuff is fueled by certain people who seem to be involved in it because of an ego thing, because it makes them feel better, because it gives a purpose to their own lives. And in that regard, it's almost like it's not even about Elvis. It could be about anyone. But these people perpetuate these myths and these stories and these claims year after year after year. But even when the evidence comes out and it's presented to them that what they believe is incorrect, they don't change their beliefs.
Let me ask you both. Patrick, do you think Elvis is dead? Yes or no?
Yes.
Gary?
Definitely yes.
I don't remember when I was talking to the two survivors of the Doors, and I asked them that question in this very studio. I said, is Jim Morrison still alive? And they looked at each other and went, no.
But, yeah, I remember that night too well, George.
Yes, you do. Absolutely. Well, both of you stay with us. We're going to continue talking about this, the anniversary, the 34th anniversary of the death of Elvis Presley. I can't believe how many years have gone by. 34 years. My gosh. Patrick Lacy, our guest, his book, Elvis Decoded. And, of course, our Gary Patterson with us as well. We'll also, time permitting in this hour, take some of your phone calls in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. If you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. Next hour, Walter Cruttenden joins us. as we talk about the lost star of myth and time. And when we come back in just a moment, Patrick Lacey, his book, Elvis Decoded, and noted author R. Gary Patterson will take your calls as we talk about the anniversary death of Elvis Presley on Coast to Coast AM. Gary, is it true that the coffin weighed over 800 pounds? That's a pretty big coffin.
It's a very big coffin, but it was also made out of, I believe it was made out of bronze and copper, and that gave it its weight. Now, of course, Patrick will tell you that one of the main, well, I guess one of the clues that a lot of people said the wax dummy was in the coffin is that it had an air conditioner in the coffin, and it was supposed to keep the dummy from melting because it was hot. And, you know, that's probably the excuse they give for it. And of course, George, I got to know Carl Perkins, and I was at a Beatle convention with him, and we had some time, and I asked him, I said, is Elvis really dead? And Carl looked at me and said, Gary, Elvis is gone. And he was at the funeral. He knew Elvis. He's one of his best friends. And after that, and that was in 1996, I never doubted it after that.
What is it about people, Patrick, that we want these people of notoriety? We want our celebrities. We want them to stay alive. I mean, I remember as a kid, 13, 14 years old, when John F. Kennedy was killed, people were they were saying he's still alive. He's in a home somewhere. You know, his brain's half gone, but he's still alive. What is it about people that keeps these people alive?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question, and I honestly don't know. It would seem to be, you know, maybe somebody needs to do some psychological, you know, examination of society, of why we do this, because we do it for a lot of people, and it doesn't make sense. And I honestly don't have an answer for you. I don't know.
Tell me about... go ahead, Gary.
Oh, I was just going to interject. I think that a lot of it, like we talked about earlier, I think that when we hear these people on the radio and we hear their songs and we build them on a platform, I mean, it goes back into history. If you were in ancient Greece, you know, athletes were honored, you know, the great soldiers in battle. And these people, you know, upon death, they were accepted to Mount Olympus as gods or demigods. So we've always placed the unreal or something that is so creative above us.
Yeah, but they didn't have the gladiators working at Taco Bell after he died.
No, they didn't. They didn't eat cheeseburgers in Kalamazoo, Michigan.
That's right.
You know, but they still, you know, the gladiators weren't as up the ladder because they were basically slaves who fought. But if you go up and you look at the, like Achilles in the Iliad, it's the idea of honoring these men who are demigods, great warriors, the history of your city. In this case, it's the history of the music, and everybody remembers growing up with it. I mean, when I heard Elvis for the first time, you know, I loved it. I was more into the Beatles and the British Invasion, but I always gave Elvis his props. And in 68, when he did the comeback tour, when he was in that black leather outfit, he just reclaimed the throne on national television. And that's the way Elvis is going to be remembered. And at the end, he became a sad parody of himself, and I think he knew that. And, you know, maybe if he had lived, George, he had had some great material written for him, because in the early days he had Lieber and Stoller and Doc Pomus and Mort Schumann writing great songs from the Brill Building, and his material suffered. And he was a victim of bad management with Colonel Parker. You know, Colonel Parker got at least 50% of what Elvis made, and Elvis had to pay the expenses out of his share.
Yeah. Well, you know, he died at 42. 42 is not an old age at all. He let himself go. He could have gotten himself back into that shape you just described, Gary.
Yes, and I think that's what the tragedy is. Because, you know, I would have liked to see him live to get himself back in that condition and to put out something that he had his heart in again.
Patrick, who is Eliza Presley, or Eliza Presley? Who is that?
Eliza Presley is a woman who came forward a few years back saying that she is the biological daughter of Elvis Presley. And when that claim didn't pan out, she shifted things a little bit and said that she is the biological daughter of Vernon Presley, thus making her Elvis's half-brother. She then decided to take this case to court and went to into Shelby County in Tennessee there and filed to get Vernon Presley's estate reopened, which it was interesting that she did that because the way that she tells the story, she she got that estate reopened because of evidence that she has proving, you know, her claim, and that Elvis is alive and she's got the DNA to prove it. However, it's to open up an estate is only a procedural matter. There was no evidence presented in court. They have to open the estate so that she can make the claim against it. If the estate is closed, she can't make her claim.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, if Elvis was her half-brother and was dead, she'd be entitled to something, maybe. What do you think?
I do not believe so. Elvis's will left everything to his daughter and in the care for his several close relatives and his father. So I don't believe she would be entitled to anything. And even if she could make that argument in some tangential way, the estate, you know, Elvis's estate has some pretty good lawyers working for him, and it wouldn't go through.
I remember interviewing a psychiatrist from Kansas City, I think, when I was in St. Louis a long time ago, Patrick, and he claimed that Elvis was his patient after the fact again, you know, well beyond 1977.
Yeah, that's Dr. Hinton.
That's him. That's it.
who came forward a number of years ago with a book that he said that Elvis wrote, and he claims that Elvis is living as his deceased twin brother, Jesse Garon Presley, and that Dr. Hinton was treating this man through the mail and, you know, shipping drugs to him. And Hinton eventually ran into a lot of problems because somebody complained to the Healing Arts Board, I think it was there in Missouri. But an interesting thing about Dr. Hinton, though, is that he said in an interview one time that he couldn't believe out of millions of doctors that he was chosen to be Elvis Presley's personal physician.
Well, I asked him that same question. I couldn't believe it either.
But now here's the thing. Here's one little interesting piece of information that he leaves out, though. He, for a very long time, has been a hardcore supporter and believer of Elvis having faked his death.
Uh-huh.
This goes back to before he was a doctor. This goes back to the early 90s. When he was deeply involved in the Elvis is Alive underground. So for him to come out later and say, I can't believe I was chosen, is extremely intellectually dishonest, because he knew good and well why he was chosen.
It is an amazing story. Let's take some calls here. Let's go to Rick in Kentucky. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi, Rick.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Go ahead.
I just wanted to interject a little bit of what I was doing at the time and what I know about it. And I actually worked for a record store in Iowa. At the time, I was with Capitol Records, and they owned a chain of stores throughout the United States. And back then, actual reps would come into your stores and like about every 6 weeks just to see how you were doing and if you needed any PLP stuff or anything
sure.
like that. And the day Elvis died, my RCA rep came in like a couple of days later. He said, I'm going to give you a heads up, Rick. If you want to know, if you want anything by Elvis, you need to order it now. And he was talking about, I don't know if y'all are aware of this, I'm sure Gary is, that about 60% of Elvis's albums were out of print then. I mean, they were gone. You couldn't get them. But, you know, because just like y'all said, I mean, he was on his way down and really had not had a good album out in several years. And so they started reprinting everything the day he died.
Oh, my gosh. It must have been like a printing press.
Oh, and, well, you know, this is straight from the RCA rep. He said that, Rick, I know you weren't around when the Beatles were out, and he happened to work for Capitol back then. He said, but this is the closest phenomenon you're going to see to what it was like when the Beatles would release an album. And he said that literally they had rented. Back then, they had only several companies actually had presses that were pressing records. I mean, RCA had presses. Capitol had presses. Warner Brothers had a couple. Columbia had a bunch. Well, they actually rented all the presses when they weren't pressing their own labels, or they were pressing RCA Elvis stuff. They'd literally just taken over everything.
Huge business at the time. Hey, Rick, thank you for sharing that with us. Gary, when Elvis went on the Ed Sullivan Show, and this was after he was on the Steve Allen Show, and I think Steve Allen beat Sullivan in the ratings for the very first time ever. Ed, who I don't think wanted Elvis on the show, did he? Changed and put him on three times?
It's amazing what your viewing audience ratings will do for you.
You know, but when Steve Allen had him on, he had him singing Hound Dog to a dog dressed up in a tuxedo.
That's right.
Because
he
Steve
clowned
Allen
him up.
Was,
yeah.
Right. Steve Allen was the natural enemy of rock and roll. And he tried to embarrass him, but Elvis played it in good sport. He did a great job and made a lot of fans. When he was on Ed Sullivan at first didn't want to touch him because rock and roll was considered a main cause of juvenile delinquency. But when he met Elvis, and of course they didn't film him from the waist down, but when he met him, he actually brings him up and he says, "This is a decent, good young man." And that opened Ed Sullivan's eyes. So he didn't. He maybe didn't want him in the first, but he saw the phenomena of Elvis Presley.
Did that appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show explode Elvis's career?
Oh, I'm sure. You know, even that and with Steve Allen, because, you know, rock and roll was new. And that's how you got your audience. You watched it on television. And a lot of records were restricted because in the South, black artists couldn't be played on white radio stations. So what Elvis did... And, you know, a lot of people give Elvis trouble on this because Patrick will say that, you know, he ripped off black artists. But when you take...
Like Chuck Berry, right?
Well, yeah, but, you know, here's the thing. Little Richard came out in 54, and, you know, he comes out and he says, listen, Elvis Presley was an integrator. He made it possible for black musicians' music to be played because everyone wanted to go to the roots that Elvis was listening to. So, thanks to Elvis Presley, a lot of black artists got their due, and they got on radio stations, and that helped. And, yeah, the phenomenon of television. You know, actually, ironically, Carl Perkins was going to be the first rock star to be on television, and he had an accident on the way up to the studio. I think it was Perry Como, and he was in the hospital. One of his brothers died.
Oh.
Elvis goes on television, and so Elvis locks it. Now, Elvis was handsome. He was younger than Carl Perkins, but Carl also wrote the song Blue Suede Shoes, and Elvis did a remarkable version of that. But yeah, it launched rock and roll, and everybody went out and bought Elvis records, and it was a great marketing plan by the Colonel.
Patrick, tell us about Elvis Decoded.
Elvis Decoded is a book that I started writing. It actually didn't start as a book. It started as me just taking notes when I was reading various Elvis books back in the mid-90s, and I found that a lot of the information just didn't seem to match up where one book would make a claim and the next five books that I read would tell me something different about that claim. And as my notes and questions started adding up, I just started putting it into book form and started talking to people and tried to sort out a lot of what I believe was wrong with the Elvis information back then, and I believe largely continues now. And in the book, I've touched on a lot of different topics. I've looked at the Elvis is Alive topics, and especially the death, the autopsy, the drug use, as much as I could.
Okay, let's go to Austin, Texas. David, take it away. You're on Coast to Coast.
Hey, George. Sorry, forgot your name.
It's Gary and Patrick over here.
Gary and Patrick. Hello, gentlemen. Yeah, I'm not only in my 40s. I, you know, grew up and listened to Elvis before he died, and kind of got into a lot of music at the time that was probably, you know, was way before my time. But, you know, over the years, I guess my thing is, you know, society, kind of what society does to these musicians and everything, how they're portrayed. And I think, you know, almost like reputation there almost kind of precedes the actual artist, you know, just they get so big. So they're almost like, you know, like you were saying earlier, bigger than life. And one thing about the drug use is, you know, Elvis really, he didn't really flaunt it around or anything like that. It was kind of nothing that I've seen. I don't remember him. Like when you think of like people like, you know, Jimi Hendrix and then people, you know.
Well, he would appear, though, once in a while, Dave, on stage, totally out of it. I mean, slurring his words. There's some things on YouTube which are downright sad, aren't they, Gary?
I know. Yeah.
I mean, you see him stumbling along. Go ahead, Dave.
Well, what I was going to say is it's almost like society kind of picks the characters that they're going to, you know, kind of put up on that pedestal. And Elvis was great. I loved his music. But he did die of, you know, of a drug overdose. And I remember growing up, there was for a lot of years, there was this commercial about, like, a partnership for a drug-free America. And you see, like, River Phoenix and John Belushi, and then you see, like, Jimi Hendrix. but no Elvis. Like they wouldn't dare, you know, put Elvis on there. And what's kind of funny is, you know, Jimi Hendrix, he died with asphyxiation or something like that. I guess he choked on his own vomit, but actually didn't die of a drug overdose. So I kind of wonder why society kind of picks certain people like Elvis, and they don't really, you know, they kind of still hold them up there even after all the bad things they do. And then there are certain people that they say, well, you know, hey, this guy was a big drug user. This guy, why do you think they just picked Elvis? Really not to, you know.
Let's jump on that, Patrick. Why Elvis?
Well, I think that Elvis, since the drug use has come out and everybody understands it now, I think that people understand that he was using drugs. Now, during the time, he did keep it under wraps, which was a lot easier to do because he was taking prescription medication. You know, he wasn't shooting up or going out on the street buying stuff.
He didn't want to do that because he didn't want to be perceived as being a junkie, right?
And he, in fact, had not a public stance, but a stance within the group of people that he was with back then, where he was kind of anti-drug, where his stepbrothers would get into drug problems, and he would, you know, give them the speech and tell them, you know, drugs are bad, this, that, and the other. So Elvis may not have even had a full awareness of exactly what he was doing with his own drug use and how it was affecting his health. Now, you can look back at that now and say, well, that could just be that he was deluding himself and he was aware. But there's a middle ground there where I think the drugs had become so bad for him that he kind of lost touch with reality a little bit on what he was doing.
Well, he was also grossly obese at the time, out of shape. He was out of shape,
but I wouldn't call him grossly obese. I think his weight has been exaggerated because the media so often portrays him based on, you know, food and, you know, cheeseburgers.
Right, but he sure looked puffy to me, though.
I think that was largely water. I mean, well, he was overweight. But a lot of what you see, and if you look at the tour, photos of the tours over 1977, one week he'll look really bad, the next week he'll look okay. And it almost seemed like maybe that was some water weight that because his body wasn't processing things properly, you know, like where one day he would look great and one day he would look terrible. That's speculation on my part.
Let's grab Richard in Las Vegas real fast, Richard, before the clock gets us. Go ahead.
Okay. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. You know, I have a different kind of perspective. I had a chance to meet Priscilla. She came in to our karate school. He learned Kaju Kembo from my teacher, not Mr. Parker. My teacher actually gave him his black belt. And when I saw them, and I always think of, when I saw her, I always think of the song, Now You Got Me Worried About the Clock. Different Minds, what's it called?
Separate Ways?
The song that they sing in the movie, not the 3,000 Miles to Graceland, but the other one. Different Minds.
Always on My Mind?
Yeah. Pardon me?
You Were Always on My Mind, that one?
No, no.
Probably
Suspicious
Ways.
Minds.
Yeah, that's
all right, there you go.
There you go. That's the one. And I think that what we're talking about here is a really good singer who sang really good songs like Dean Martin in his time.
But he did it in that rock and roll genre. Gary, my friend, keep in touch. And Patrick, good luck with the work. Elvis Decoded.
Thanks a lot, George.
Both of you. Take care of yourself. On this, the anniversary, if you can believe it or not, 34 years ago, Elvis Presley died. Where were you? Do you remember? I remember where I was when Kennedy died. I was in school at the age of 13. I was 27 when Elvis passed on. I remember that, too. Split show for you. Up next, Walter Cruttenden joins us for an hour as we talk about the lost star of Myth and Time. Get ready for that on Coast to Coast AM.